Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and today Randy Overbeck is here to talk about his just published Blood on the Chesapeake. Welcome, Randy.
I'm glad to be here.
I didn't know what to expect when I started reading your book. A ghost sets the story in motion, but it's very much a classic whodunit. So my question is, when you set out to write the book, were you thinking about a ghost story with a mystery or a mystery with a ghost?
I actually started the story, the early drafts of the narrative are without the ghost. The ghost was something that kind of came to me partway through the brainstorming session early in my deliberations.
So you would say that it is a mystery with a ghost.
Yes, I generally, when I'm sending out information and people are asking about it, I call it a ghost story / mystery.
So let's talk about Daryl Henshaw, your protagonist, and what brought him to Wilshire, Maryland.
Well, Daryl is a fairly new teacher. He's a high school social studies teacher, very committed to kids, and had a fairly successful couple of years in his hometown up in Michigan. But he was scheduled to marry another teacher and found out just before the wedding that she was cheating on him, and kind of upset and concerned and embarrassed, decided he needed to find a new place. Did what teachers do, sent out a lot of applications and resumes, and eventually one came back from this small town on the Chesapeake Shore that he had never been to. And he thought, well, that's a great place to start over, so I'll go there.
And the ghost he encounters at the school isn't the first time the spirit of a person who has passed on has reached out to him. And do you think there are people that are more receptive to ghosts? And it's not as if Daryl welcomes visits from ghosts. His first experience triggered an obsessive-compulsive disorder in him.
Correct. Before I wrote the book, I did a great deal of research on ghost hunting and experiences that had been documented of people who have had ghosts. And I wanted to make, although it's clearly fiction, it's not real, but I wanted to make the pieces of the paranormal as close to what had been experienced elsewhere. So one of the things that's different about my protagonist as opposed to other ghost stories is this is not somebody who welcomes his visits from the other side. I do believe that like most everything else, there are some people who are better and more sensitive to the spirit world than others, just like there are some people that are better playing basketball or painting a picture or writing a story. Some are more tuned into others, and Daryl is among that group, even though once he discovers it, and the manner in which he discovers it makes him extremely uncomfortable and then eventually ignites the OCD that he's got to try to control things around him.
And we touched on the location of Wilshire. The eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay is rich in history, but it's rather remote. And I was wondering, you know, you live in the Midwest, Daryl comes from Michigan, and I was curious what drew you to set this book and future books in this series, if hopefully it's going to be a series, in this location.
Well, it is going to be a series. This is, right now, it's the first of three stories called The Haunted Shore Mysteries. And my intent is to set each one in a resort location, but a resort location that's not real well known, not super famous, not the name that would be on everybody's list when they say resort. I chose the Eastern Shore because about a dozen years ago, we kind of stumbled into this absolutely beautiful place. We were looking. This is a really interesting story. I went to my travel agent and said, look, I want to go someplace where we could sit and watch the sunset. We could sit and watch the sunset over the water. We can sit back and relax. I don't want it busy. We don't do, my wife doesn't go into the water very much, so that's not a real big issue. And we wouldn't be able to sit in rocking chairs on the deck and walk. And believe it or not, my travel agent found a place in the small town of Oxford, Maryland, that is just an absolutely beautiful bed and breakfast. And we stayed there and fell in love. We have since been back about 6 times. Just because the place is so mesmerizing. Beautiful water, shores. You can get anything you want. And you want to see a beach, otherwise you got that. You want to see a rocky shore, you want to see this beautiful wooded that goes right up to the... All of those things are exist in this tranquil, quiet area. And so it is kind of a love letter to the area because I love it. And I thought it was a great place. It also has characteristics that, as this story was developing, my head fit so perfectly for the story. So I don't know how many people know this, but this is an area with a great deal of history that has a lot of dichotomy to it. So it's basically a New England-type town. So it's very, very British. You can tell by the names. So the towns are Oxford, Cambridge, St. Michael's, Easton. Those are all the names in this particular area that I set this in. But it also has very close ties to the South. So you don't have to drive very far around on the eastern shore to see a Confederate flag. In fact, it was a very big slave-owning place. And during the Civil War, there were very split loyalties in this area. And because there's this kind of push-pull between these cultures in the area, it worked very effectively in my story to have the same kind of push-pull between the old Southern Guard and the more modern New England Guard.
Well, the story toggles between the mid-60s and the Civil Rights Movement and the present day. And as you just mentioned, a lot may have changed, but some things haven't changed as much as maybe they should have. So that's an element that sort of makes the core of the story and what Daryl is trying to uncover.
Right. And Daryl is being confronted with the reality of the racial injustice that occurred 30-some years earlier. In the story, he begins to look around and see examples of the same, not the same extent, but the same racial injustice that exists in the area there. And part of my intent is a metaphor for the current area. So just as we went from the early 60s to 98, we could jump from 98 to 20 years later to now, and we are still seeing some of the same problems that the theme of the book is based on.
That's right. I should have said that it was the story is set right before the turn of the 21st century. And I'm always curious why writers set stories in the time frame that they do. I have a theory about why you might have done it, but it would be much more interesting to listen to your answer to that.
Well, I'm intrigued by this particular time, but part of the reason that I did that was purely practical. So it's really funny because I had this exact same conversation with Ken Follett when I was working under him at a writing conference, and he asked me the same question. He said, "Well, why don't you set that now as opposed to in the 90s? And I said, "Well, first of all, the touch point of the story is a lynching, and in order for that to be realistic, there weren't any lynchings in this country after the early 60s. It just didn't. By that point, fortunately, society had pushed that practice out. So I had to back the story up and say, okay, if this happens in 61 or 62, 63, 64, when the other lynchings occurred, then how old could the antagonists be that they could still be reasonably powerful in the current story. So that left me with this gap of this particular time. So if when they were young, when this happened in the beginning, and that puts them in their 50s in a very powerful position in 1999. So those are the kinds of reasons the story is built around that structure of time.
And I thought some people set stories before the turn of the 21st century because of technology. There are no cell phones or much fewer cell phones, and service is much more sparse, and it's not as connected a society. Cell phones, I think, have really played havoc with a lot of mystery writers' plotting and plot points.
Right, because it does change things, and I did think about that. That really wasn't a driving force of setting it at that particular date. In fact, in the second book, which takes place the year later in 99, Daryl gets his first cell phone. So I'm kind of working that part into the story to a certain extent. So I'm dealing with that. But you're right. It does change the calculus that mystery writers have to make when they're trying to decide, well, how much could they know and how easy would they get that information and all that kind of stuff. This was just at the start of that tech period, so that Daryl is familiar with some of that and uses some technology. But the interesting thing, as you no doubt read, is that they have, in order to do some research, they have to do on microfilm. Well, I had to figure out how I was going to make that clear to the reader, because most readers don't even know what that is. They're in front of a microfilm reader before, even though they still exist, and libraries still have them. Some libraries still have, especially older ones. But it was an interesting challenge, and I loved doing it.
Well, it was for those of us who've researched books, and you know, there's still a lot of material, especially newspaper archives, that are not readily available. They haven't been digitized, and that means a trip to usually the central library or a university library, and somebody's going to deliver a box full of rolled film, and you're going to put it in this machine and do your best to read it.
Which is pretty much what Daryl and Aaron had to do.
You know, I find that, you know, secrets, arrogance, and power are very often mixed up in a mystery's DNA. And that was the case in your book, in Blood on the Chesapeake. It often stops me, like, what are the motives of these characters, the characters sort of in opposition to Daryl and Aaron? And do you think this is driven by the desire to recreate the good old days? I'm asking you to get into some of your characters' heads. You know, why they wanted to make all of this secret instead of showing how much, maybe not truthfully, but how much the community had progressed and how much better things were than they were in the 60s. Instead, they're doing their best to just, you know, keep things covered up.
In order to do this book, I did a good deal of research on small towns that had been involved in lynching. In fact, the part in the novel that I make a reference to, it is true that less than 30 miles from where this is set, there's actually two lynchings on the Eastern Shore a few decades earlier. And it was true of those towns, it's true of most towns. What happened in most towns where lynchings occurred is that years later, most of everything about the lynchings has been covered up. For example, almost all lynchings that have any documented evidence, there's a large group of people that witnessed it, you know, people came out to cheer them on, you know, just exactly what you would think. But years later, decades later, when the story is going back, no one will admit to be there. No one will admit that this ever happened. I didn't see it happen. And that I found to be the case in location after location. So I thought the idea of, in this case, our antagonist burying and coming up with this alternative explanation fit exactly with what the historical record says. Not only does it fit their motives, it fits what actually happened in other places.
So a sort of collective amnesia, and Daryl as a outsider coming in can sort of pierce that veil, not just the veil between life and the hereafter, but this peel back the layers of this amnesia and try to get to the truth. He's driven to do it. He's compelled to do it by the visitations, by the ghost, and just by who he is.
Yeah, well, I think what I hope to do, his primary, once he gets past the "I don't want to deal with another ghost" issue, which is a big deal for him, his primary motivation is he cares about kids. He cares immensely about the children he serves, and eventually he comes to see that this is just another teen that needed help. And so he is going to whatever length he has to be able to provide that help for that teen. And I tried to make the revelation, when the discussion in the book comes up between Aaron and Daryl about the, quote, potential lynching, Aaron, the person who's been brought up and been told everything by the town, goes, well, he hung himself. And Daryl is the one that goes, wait. He hung himself naked? Did you ever hear anybody do? So he's able to, as an outsider, to question what the collective amnesia or the collective knowledge of what really occurred, and therefore helps him get to the bottom of it with the help of the ghost.
Right. The ghost, but the ghost is a presence and a guide. He doesn't take Daryl by the hand. He's not able to physically do much, so the best he can do is leave clues. I thought that was really well done, because it would be easy for the ghost to fully enter the world of the living and tell Daryl what to do and how to do it and what happened to him, but he's limited by the fact that he's not alive. And Daryl has to follow the clues, which is, I think, part and parcel of a whodunit.
Well, and I tried to make it so that, so that it is at least as close, even though I've already had some ghost hunter complain that it's not realistic. And I'm going, well, of course it's not realistic. It's fiction. It never happened. But if you read what goes, they will tell you that there's ghosts don't really tell you things. They leave information. They point to something. They indicate something. What I was trying to do, Nancy, was I was trying not to be what I call, I didn't want my book to be another Casper the Friendly Ghost. Okay? I've enjoyed those where somebody inherits this bookstore from my aunt, and when I get there, I find there's a ghost in there, and the ghost helps me solve mysteries. I mean, I'm not being critical of that. It's just not what I wanted to do. So I wanted to do something that was a little closer to what ghosts really do, or at least what's believed they do, and also make it a little harder for our protagonist to solve the mystery.
So the ghost's appearances notwithstanding, Daryl seems to be enjoying his new job and his new girlfriend. And you mentioned that the next book happens the following year, which is 1999. So can you tell us a little bit about that and what we can expect?
Yeah, the second book is set in Cape May, New Jersey. Now, if you're not familiar with the East Coast, you might not know that, but Cape May, New Jersey is reported to be the most haunted town on the eastern seaboard. So I had to get Daryl to another place. So without creating too many spoilers, Daryl has some work problems that have been created by people who are not happy with what he uncovered in Wilshire, and he has do some temporary employment elsewhere, and that lands him in Cape May. And then in Cape May, he encounters another ghost who has another similar societal issue that that Daryl has to deal with. This one is about human trafficking instead of racial injustice.
It's not really a spoiler to ask if Daryl is a little bit calmer about his ghostly encounter in this next book, or is he still have a great deal of trepidation with his talent?
His trepidation still exists, but not as much. He is still not happy after all having what he had to go through with the ghost in Wiltshire, and having it almost cost him his life. He is not happy to see another ghost enter his life. But in the second book, he accepts that inevitability a little more quickly than he does in the first book.
Well, it sounds terrific, and I look forward to the next one in the series. I found this book very entertaining and a really, really good mystery. And like I said, I think it was more a mystery with a ghost than a ghost story with a mystery, because the humans had to take care of it. The people on this side of the living had to solve what was going on, and I enjoyed it, so thank you.
I appreciate that. I was hoping that there is a market. Right now, if you try to read a ghost story, everything I've encountered are either Casper the Friendly Ghost or ghosts like Stephen King creates that scare the bejeevers out of you. So I was looking for something that's kind of in the middle of that. I'm hoping that I accomplish that with this particular mystery and ghost story.
You're actually not alone. Jo Perry writes a series, her Dead series, Dead is Better, Dead is Best, about a ghost and a ghost dog that help the living solve mysteries. And they're not scary. And your book wasn't scary either. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you for joining us and talking about Blood on the Chesapeake. And I look forward to the next book, which I'm assuming will be out next year.
My hope is that it will be out in time for Halloween of 2020.
Perfect timing.
That's what I'm hoping.
Well, thanks again, Randy, and hopefully we'll get a chance to catch up next year.
I will look forward to it.